My watch tells me that it is very soon 3 o'clock. And my name is Andreas Oderfors. I'm the director of the Center for Research into Freemasonry and Fraternalism at the University of Sheffield, a center that is belonging to the Department of History. And in my capacity, it's my great pleasure and honor to welcome today Professor Margaret Jacob, who is one of the key researchers in the area and who has made enormous contributions to make the topic of research into Freemasonry established at academic level. So we are happy, very happy to have you here today, Margaret. It is also my pleasure to tell you that we have a direct cooperation with the UCLA through a memorandum of understanding between our center and the Department of History, or rather the social science faculty at the UCLA. We also had to happy to have in the audience postdoctoral researcher at the UCLA, Nathalie Bayer, who will develop a course on Freemasonry at the UCLA for UCLA students. And that is a development that we think is highly interesting to us, and we will also try to do our best to support that development. So it is not only a one-off, it is the fruits of a long cooperation. Margaret Jacob was also here when the Douglas Noob Center was inaugurated more than 3 years ago, back in 2006. I have to say personal apologies if I leave early, because I will take over the watch in Newcastle. Margaret has worked there a couple of days in an archive in Newcastle, and I will go there tonight to present a lecture at the Northumbrian Lodge of Installed Masters in Newcastle, which is one part of my duties, is to go around to Masonic lodges in this country and present lectures on Freemasonry. I will talk about Freemasonry and the press in the 18th century. And one thing I immediately see in the heading of your lecture, Margaret, is the private in the public, which is exactly also something that is a topic of researching Freemasonry in the press in the 18th century. So I look very much forward to your talk here today, and the floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see this kind of cooperation between private societies and the university. We are far away from such an ideal in the States, but we're working on it. I'm setting up here a problem that is larger than Freemasonry, and that is the very nature of civil society in modernity. But I want to use the records of a Masonic lodge in France to try to get at this paradox of why would an association, a voluntary association, embrace secrecy as a way of conducting itself? And how does this work? How does this interface of the public and the private work if we assume that one of the hallmarks of modernity is the viability and independence of civil society, that it is increasingly difficult for states to control private socializing, public fraternizing? This is especially true first, I think, in England and the Dutch Republic. But increasingly, we also see this emerging in Paris. The best guide we have to the vibrancy of civil society in Paris are the police reports, because unlike the situation in both England and the Netherlands, in France, the police watched civil society very closely. They found all the comings and goings and toings and froings of gentlemen who had no obvious reason to meet. They were not in the same family. They were not in the same profession. This was regarded as inherently suspect. And so the spy reports and police reports, many of them at Arsenal, the library, that received all the records of the Bastille, which is why police reports are there, give us a marvelous window into what was going on in Paris in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Here I want to take the records that we associate with Freemasonry and try to probe how this private-public interface was actually working. Now, we can assume, I think, reasonably, that commerce is at the very heart of modernity. And commerce, by definition, implies anonymity, it implies public activity, it implies the ability of strangers to do business one with another. But I want first to illustrate something about commerce, even in the late 18th century. And that is that we have actually got a drawing of the Royal Exchange in London made by a visiting French engineer in the 1780s. And what's so fascinating about this drawing, if you can see, it's not very distinct, the next slide will be more distinct. Notice here the place of the Jews, the Quakers up at the very top of the screen. Here we have an absolute public venue where men of religions that are sometimes persecuted, sometimes seen as odd, have chosen to congregate together. They're not like the druggists or the drapers or the Spanish merchants. They've come together because of their religious affiliation. This might give you a clearer sense of it. People stood according to their occupations, according to their businesses, and of course according to their nations, because this is a scene for international trade and commerce. But even in this most public venue, we can see traces of the kind of privacy that we will witness at work in the Masonic lodges. This brings me to a quite extraordinary document, actually, one that only came back to us, by us I mean the West, in the very early years of this century. This is one of the many records of Bordeaux Freemasonry. In 1940, the Nazis, when they stormed into France, went obviously to the synagogues, but also to the grand lodges and to the main lodges in the big cities, and confiscated everything that they could get their hands on. We sometimes forget that the Nazis believed that there was a Jewish Masonic conspiracy. And so they sent all this material back to Berlin, where there was an institute that employed over 200 people for the purpose of sorting through all this material in order to show the roots and activities of this conspiracy. I suppose we can be glad these people were employed. It's most unclear that they ever found anything of any consequence. As the Russian army approached, all this material was taken out into the countryside and hidden in a chateau in Silesia, and there the Russian army got it, took it back to Moscow, and it sat in Moscow until the 1990s, when an American historian at Harvard, Patricia Grimstead, quite by happenstance, was informed that there's this so-called secret archive, and within it there were meters upon meters upon meters, vast, vast archives of everything from Freemasonry to liberal political parties to the synagogues, etc., the Jewish singing societies. All of this had made its way back to Moscow. This particular extract, let's see, can I go backwards in this system? I think I can, yes. This is a record that was made in 1817 for the master of Bordeaux Freemasonry by, presumably, the secretary. And what it is it goes through the entire set of minutes that once existed from 1732 onward and picks out the important things, what should be known about what happened in July of 1746, and June of 1792, etc., and writes out the salient points, the important things that need to be part of the historical record. Unfortunately, those minutes do not survive. Instead, what we have is this extract. And from the look of it, it seems to me to be perfectly authentic. It some of the things in its catalog, you would fully expect to see the ordinary meeting records of any lodge anywhere in Europe. This happens to be the Lodge of the English, and I suspect these original records may have been in English and are here being translated, or maybe not, because they're from, if you rely on the surnames, there are a majority of the people in this lodge are Anglo-Irish, but there are also some French names. So this may have been a particularly cosmopolitan gathering where gentlemen of both English and French trades have come together to celebrate. You can see some of the names, Patrick Dixon of Dublin, Martin Kelly, and so on. These are people who are described as merchants in Bordeaux, quite possibly in the wine trade, we don't know. And this lodge had a continuous history that went right up to 1940. What can it tell us? What can these records tell us about the role played by secrecy in such an organization? Put it very crudely, what have they got to hide? Why is secrecy being embraced? First of all, we're being told here, right at the bottom of this record in 1746, that a lodge of adoption, the Sisters of Adoption, has been opened in Bordeaux. And the brothers are not pleased. This is the earliest record we have from anywhere in Europe that shows the existence of women's Freemasonry, or so-called lodges of adoption. So what we can see already happening here is that within this public-private umbrella that the lodges created, there are people already, in this case women, pushing at the envelope and wanting to expand the membership of the lodges. And this was seen as no less than scandalous by some of the brothers in this lodge. But there were other things that perhaps they didn't want to advertise to the public. That, by the way, is an apron from a lodge of adoption of a later period than the record shows. But I think you can see the employing of fairly standard Masonic symbols, complete with a pink ribbon, perhaps intended to indicate that a woman would be wearing this apron. One of the things we learn from these records is that the intendant, the king's representative, had come to the master of the lodge and basically told him that they were no longer to meet. This is a significant year. It's 1742, when Cardinal Fleury is still very much in charge. He will die the following year. But Fleury regarded the Freemasons as enemies of the church, and this is a mere 4 years after the papal condemnation of 1738. And so it is the purpose here of the Entendant to close this assembly down. What we learn from the following minutes of the next month is that what they decided to do was move their venue. So here we have an example of the state and a branch of civil society playing a kind of cat and mouse game. Clearly, the Freemasons are not so worried that they stop meeting, but they are sufficiently careful so as to discreetly change where they are meeting. This signals also that the state is watching. Unlike many other parts of Northern Europe, this is a place where the absolutist system of government has taken upon itself to monitor the activities of civil society. And though right there you have a reason why the umbrella of secrecy, the affectation of secrecy, could indeed be rather useful. But then there's more. Now we discover that a brother has behaved in a way that is indecent and imperious. But this brother happens to be the curé of a local town near Bordeaux. This is a Catholic priest who has made his way happily, it would seem, to Freemasonry, although not so happy perhaps for his brothers that find him behaving improperly. But right there, in particularly in Catholic Europe, the need to maintain discretion about membership in the lodges was absolutely essential. We can see this more clearly, from the records of Freemasonry in Avignon. Avignon was papal territory at this time, and there we can see Freemasons being hauled in by the Inquisition for questioning. In some cases, their lodges raided, and the garments and aprons and whatnot taken away by the authorities. The same thing happens in Naples in this period. So this is the one thing that makes France different here in Catholic Europe, is that the Inquisition does not meet on French territory. Avignon is not French territory. But it also means that priests are able to join lodges, and indeed the records of other lodges show that quite a number of abbés and curés made their way into the society. Here's another religious, this time a Celestian brother, presumably, who's also made his way to the lodge against the orders of the Pope. But the Pope is far away, and the lodge is nearby. And presumably there are benefits to lodge membership for a religious person. And we don't know exactly what those benefits would be, but clearly this Celestinian does not see Freemasonry as inherently contradictory to his religious beliefs. At least we can make that assumption by the fact that he has turned up, along with various other abbés, into the lodge. But notice, there are limits to meeting upon the level where all brothers meet, and that limit is reached when it comes to actors. Actors and actresses, particularly again in Catholic Europe, you see this also in the Dutch Republic, but it's not as serious in the Dutch and English cases. Actors and actresses are seen as socially unacceptable. This is because they mimic human actions, and they are also have a reputation for living loose lives. And here the lodge is saying absolutely no instrument players from the comedy are going to be allowed into the lodge. So clearly this is a form of civil society that's negotiating its way to finding its own sense of respectability. How far will it go to have men meet upon the level? Well, clearly actors and actresses, or obviously actors, are beyond the pale. And it has to be said, in other parts of France, the way this problem is solved is that lodges specifically for actors are set up. We see that happening in Strasbourg. So this is a form of civil society that is not trying to tear down all the social barriers, despite the pressure that's being put on it here by actors who clearly want to join, or by women who also, in exactly the same year, are forming their own lodge. In 1747, a gentleman by the name of Signor Capodose, a Portuguese Jew from Amsterdam, turns up in the lodge, at the lodge of the English, saying that he was made a Mason in Amsterdam and that he wants to break bread with his fellow brothers, as he would be able to do in Amsterdam. Clearly, the lodge turns him down, but look, 2 years later, he's back again, demanding the same rights, saying that he belongs to the Lodge de la Paix in Amsterdam, and why can't he be a member here in good standing? Never will Jews be admitted, the Lodge responds. And here we see that religious differences, religious prejudices at work in the formation of civil society. And here, perhaps secrecy covers over the prejudices that are at work in this particular lodge. Now, we know quite a bit about Signor Capodose. He's also from a very prominent Portuguese Jewish family in Amsterdam. We also know quite a bit about his lodge, because we know it's Freeman, we know its master, Jean-Roussel de Missy, who is the head of this lodge, de la Paix, and he is a French Huguenot refugee about whom Farabit is known because he left behind a massive correspondence that is now at the University Library in Leiden, much of it concerning Freemasonry. And he has obviously opened the doors of the lodge to Jewish members. This was true in Dutch Freemasonry from the get-go, from the beginning of formal Dutch Masonry, which is in 1734. There we see, again, if you can go by surnames, a Jew by the name of Solomon Noch is one of the founding members of Dutch Freemasonry. Another thing that's interesting about Rousset de Missy and some of his brothers, perhaps, we don't know, is that privately he described himself as a pantheist. In other words, he does not subscribe to anything that might be remotely described as orthodox in relation to the monotheistic religions of the time, either Judaism or Christianity. So perhaps it's his heretical inclinations that permit him to take into his space someone who, for whom much of the rest of Europe would find it difficult to admit as a brother, as an implied equal. Now, something more strange than simply turning down a Jewish member or having abbés and curés in the lodge is the appearance in this particular report of a clandestine lodge in the city of Bordeaux. And you read this and you say, well, isn't the first crowd sort of clandestine? I mean, how do you get to the second crowd being clandestine if indeed they're all meeting under the rubric of secrecy? Well, this is one of the phenomena that is very common in European Freemasonry throughout the 18th century, and that is the desire to set up independent lodges, lodges that do not get charters from a grand lodge, that go their own way, that have their own rules, sometimes have their own rituals, suggesting here that this form of sociability is seen as desirable and worth imitating, but also imitating it on one's own terms. Hence, a lodge that is, by the official brothers, seen as clandestine. And we will learn from the records that here, on this occasion, the lodge will turn to the local authorities to try to get them to close down this irregular lodge. Also, at this same moment, a prince from India is being admitted into Bordeaux Freemasonry. This is one of the earliest records we have that show non-Westerner membership in the Western lodges. We don't know why this prince is in Bordeaux at this time, but what is important here is that this lodge is on one level capable of this kind of cosmopolitan fraternizing. I'm sure it helped that he was a prince, and he could be admitted where a European Jew could not. Also, charity, the second item, tells us that a brother has spent time in prison in London, probably in debtor's prison, and here he's being given 50 francs by the lodge. Then, as now, charity required a certain discretion. And the lodge here is capable, as are many lodges, particularly on the continent, but also in Britain, of giving charity to one of their own as a way of shoring up brotherhood, expressing brotherhood. But also, it was convenient that few knew that this act of generosity had occurred. Another religious member now, a Benedictine, has been initiated. So what we see here is that throughout the century, I'm just picking up a few of these highlights, but throughout the century there's a steady stream of Catholic religious coming into the lodge. No one has really written anything about these particular brothers. I think it would be most interesting to try to assess what could this have meant to a Benedictine. How does he reconcile his membership in something the Pope says is bad with his obviously religious nature? Or perhaps his religious nature is only skin deep or surface deep, and in his heart, he's looking for something better. This trouble, this constant concern about irregular or clandestine lodges reaches a high point in 1764 when we are told that there's a bastard lodge meeting in the city, and once again, the authorities are contacted to close this thing down. What's interesting about it is that the head of this group is called Martin de Pasquale. He is a known commodity. We don't know as much about him as we would like to know. He is said in the literature to have been a Portuguese Jew, but we don't have actual confirmation of that. But he leads an entire spiritual movement centered around Freemasonry that seeks to use the Masonic Lodges as an umbrella organization that will encompass all the religions of the world. Last year, I was lecturing to a lodge in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and one of the brothers came up and told me that he was a Martinist. And I hadn't realized that Martinism had continued, that there's a presence of this particular set of beliefs within Freemasonry right until today. What's important about Martinism is that it looks toward these syncretic movements that are commonplace in Europe in the 1770s and 1780s. It's in that period that the term theosophy takes on meaning in Masonic circles, and we can see a group like the Philadelphies, the Lodge of Philadelphies in Paris, meeting around the assumption that they have discovered a universal religion that will work throughout the world. Here we have then civil society, as it were, breaking out of its borders and becoming a form of religiosity. Curiously enough, becoming just what the church feared it was going to be or was all along. This movement toward the mystical, which is, as I said, common in the 1770s and 80s, is also, as Natalie would be the first to tell you, very common in Russia in this period, perhaps more common in Russia, Russian Freemasonry, than anywhere else on the continent. And we can only offer, at this point, hypotheses as to why this movement occurs, and occurs in particular, it's rare in English and Dutch Freemasonry, but it's commonplace in French and German Freemasonry and Russian Freemasonry. Could this be some kind of response to the relative paralysis that elites feel in relation to the absolutist state? Unless you're a part of the bureaucracy, unless you're a part of the court, you are relatively powerless. Can this search for some kind of unifying religion be a way of addressing the authority that is given to the church, particularly, again, in Catholic settings? We don't know. Somebody's going to have to study this and tell us. The revolution. Here the lodge is celebrating this happy revolution. It's July 1790, getting close to the first anniversary, the storming of Bastille. And we are virtuous French citizens. The language of the revolution has now been adopted. But notice that the health of the king is also being saluted. He is the father of the French. So this is a lodge that has embraced the revolution at this moment, but only so far. And one of the things that we learn from these records is that now in 1790-91 there is dissension in the lodge. And we can only assume that that dissension is directly tied to the events that first began in Paris the year before. The evidence of this discord in what is now the true English lodge comes from the fact that a brother, who's described in the records as a brother philosopher and a friend of humanity, has made the following proposition. the legislature of France has just given the death blow to the prejudice that forces men to hide their identity or renounce their religious opinions. In other words, Jews, in a word, are active citizens. They have the qualities required by our mores. Admit them into our care, or will you reject them? This is an important question. Here we see, under the impact of a larger political movement, a brother is trying to force open the boundaries that have been imposed by discretion and secrecy and admit a Jewish member. Clearly, this is an issue in this particular lodge. It comes back over and over again. It may have something to do with the fact that there was a fairly substantial Jewish community in Bordeaux of roughly 3,000 people, and in Paris at this time there was nothing close to that, unlike Amsterdam, where by the end of the 18th century there were probably 25,000 or 30,000 Jews in the city. The lodge, baited by this question, we're told, debated it and turned it down. There was no way that it was going to accept Jewish members. Now there's a gap. And suddenly, at the height of the terror, the lodge reassembles. Only now it has been taken over by those who want to call it the Lodge of Equality. And they want to celebrate this equality. In other words, what has happened here, it would seem, given the fact that the lodge is now reassembling and embracing equality, that the lodge has been taken over by Jacobins. So what's happening, one could argue, in the terror is that the state, in its weakened condition, has been swamped by civil society, and that this is an example of that kind of interface that happens when authority, political authority, breaks down in the center. Now, this affectation, and that's what I like to call it, an affectation of secrecy, ultimately made many enemies for the lodges. As you know, Abbé Barrowell, in this country, John Robison, blamed the French Revolution on the Freemasons. It was a conspiracy of philosophes and Freemasons. And this became one of the mainstays, one of the threads that runs through far-right propaganda right into the 20th century. I remember in the 1970s having a graduate student who came in from Spain to study for a while with us. This was in New York. And when I told him I had an interest in Freemasonry, he was shocked, and he said, "It is commonplace in Spain that there is a Jewish Masonic conspiracy." And this was Franco Spain, this was the 1970s. So this is a thread that's powerful and stays throughout European far-right thought right into the present day. And the far-right, if it is nothing else, is one of the opponents of modernity. It sees modernity as a cosmopolitan conspiracy of disreputable elements. Somewhere in the 19th century, Jacob Katz has written intelligently about this, the Masonic conspiracy merges with anti-Semitism, and the story is born that there is a Jewish Masonic conspiracy. By the late 19th century, that myth is being propagated by the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a book that Hitler knew well, and one that is still being published, mostly in Kuwait, is my understanding. There are now still about 1 million copies of this in circulation, and there is a chapter within it devoted to explaining the nature of the Jewish Masonic conspiracy. Believing in that conspiracy leads us to these boxes. This is just a fraction of the 700 boxes of Masonic archives that were returned to the Grand Orient in 2001. I believe there are still more coming in, but this is what I worked with, where I found the Bordeaux records. And you can see the Cyrillic writing the Russians had actually done a very good job of keeping these records clean and safe, storing them in these boxes, which were then in turn transported to Paris, also Brussels, and I'm told this material has been returned to The Hague. Those boxes got assembled first by the Nazis, who operated a propaganda machine around this the Jewish Masonic conspiracy. Here's an exhibition in Paris in 1942, to which school children were expected to go, and others who were sympathizers perhaps with the far right also went. The marvelous librarian in The Hague, who helped me get started in these kinds of archives, told me that he was made to go and see the exhibition in The Hague in the Grand Lodge, which showed Churchill and Roosevelt in their Masonic garb, and he decided right on the spot that he was going to become a Freemason. So these kinds of exhibitions can cut in many ways. The point here is that the affectation of secrecy, which is commonplace only really in the lodges in the 18th and 19th centuries, could also breed enemies of such virulence. This is not to suggest that lodges can stop being secret, but it is to suggest that this tension between the public and the private that is very much, I think, at the heart of the Masonic experience in the 18th century gave hostages to fortune. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. As usual, we have time for questions and comments, so I'm happy to receive any questions or comments on Margaret's lecture from the audience. If not, to start off, I can ask a question about Martin Pasquini. I didn't get it quite exactly from the document if he still was called a frère or what his title was.
He's not, in that document, to my knowledge, called Frère, but he certainly saw himself as a Frère.
Yes, yes.
And he's going around France and other parts of Europe setting up these irregular lodges.
Indeed. Right, okay. Anything you would like to come up with?
Yes.
Can I just ask about the first adoption lodge in Bordeaux and why you think that, why at that time, first of all, and secondly, whether women were purely mimicking or thought they were mimicking male lodges, or if there was something particular as well, specific about these lodges?
Well, here I'm going to defer to Jan Snoek, who's bringing a whole book out on this very subject, and I'd be interested to see what he's going to argue. I think imitation is the highest form of flattery, but I think it's more than imitation. That's one sentence. That's all we've got about that particular lodge. What we do have are the records of a lodge of adoption in The Hague in 1751. And there, and it's a French-speaking lodge, the actresses and actors in the Comédie Française, along with various high nobility, the Bentincks, for example, have joined together, and there they have set up officers in the masculine and the feminine. The maître, la maîtresse, etc. And all the officers meet together with this gendered grouping. This lodge has also left us with songs and a sermon. And both the songs and the sermons are objectively feminist. This is what the word we would put to it. They are advocating women's equality. So I think we can say that there's a way in which, I hear I'm relying on Lynn Hunt's book, Inventing Human Rights, there's a way in which once you start articulating these universals, like all men are equal, you open up the possibility that all sorts of people are going to think, am I not also equal? And we know what the results of that is in the long term. A struggle that we are still having today, many parts of the world, but also in the Western world, and the pressure to give civil rights and to permit equality, indeed legalize equality, force it, it comes from the universal nature of these claims. And I think here we're seeing, in the Lodge of Adoption, we don't know why Bordeaux, why, we don't know anything about it. But in The Hague, where we do have good records, we can say that there is a self-consciousness.
Yes. I was fascinated. You started your talk by talking about the Lodge of the English, number 240. Hmm. The fact that it says 240 gives some indication that they had got a warrant from somewhere. Do you know where from?
I do not. I didn't look very closely at the Grand Lodge of London's records to see, but I would be surprised if they'd gotten the Constitution. But maybe they did. Maybe they did.
I think it was pretty free and easy for a lot of, even around that time, and more or less you could apply to almost anyone and would make a good case and send a good letter, and probably in exchange for the necessary fee, get a warrant back.
Right. Yes, I think that's probably right. I know the Lodge de la Paix in Amsterdam claimed to get its warrant from Edinburgh, and there's not a shred of evidence to back that up, but that's where they said they got their constitution.
I was similarly going to inquire, you refer to it as the Lodge of the English. The actual name for the Lodge is the English Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered whether we know about the composition of membership during the 18th century. You referred to the composition as an earlier point, but the fact that they were insisting upon the absence of Jews quite late on into the century was rather against what would be normal English practice.
That's right. That's
so
right.
Perhaps it was more French quite early on than it was English.
Well, the very early records have the majority of names are Anglo, but there are a few French names. As the records go on, the names become more and more French. So I think that's one of the changes that may be occurring here, although English names remain as far as we can tell. I mean, we only have this set of extracts, and that I don't, there are no membership records that have survived, I don't think. So you have to go from the record to say, oh, that's a French name, that's an English name, that's an Irish name, etc.
You mentioned that the first lodges of adoption appeared on the continent in the 1740s. I'm wondering if what we know about the English lodges of adoption, when they were first established, usually in the library there is a ritual for women Freemasons from the mid-1760s, a ritual, but we don't know which lodges used that ritual. In the 1780s, I just came across a reference in the Burley collection, a reference to a lodge dedicated to Urania. It was established by women, but again, I don't know whether there was an actual lodge behind this. So what is the current state of research on lodges of adoption in this country?
In this country, I don't know of anybody who's working on it in any systematic way, but that, you know, I'm not au courant with all the scholarship that goes on around Freemasonry, British Freemasonry. The received wisdom is clearly wrong. Received wisdom is that women were never a part of British Freemasonry. But whether there's a cache of manuscripts there somewhere that we just don't know about right now that would shed some serious light on this, I can't answer it. I just don't know.
I would like to come back to the question you put here, the first image actually, why privacy and secrecy plays a role in the growth of modernity. So would you agree with the German social historical Selig that secrecy has this role of preparing things in advance in the, so to speak, the preparation of civic society that cannot take place in public space because the structure of public space is not prepared for that yet.
This is Kozelek.
Yeah.
Yeah. The problem with Kozelek is that his approach to Freemasonry is tinged by right-wing thinking. And he sees the Freemasons as having had a role in the French Revolution, an organized role, and this is just nonsense.
Mm.
So I therefore regard Kozelek's work, particularly on Masonry, I hold it at arm's length as a result, because this really is. Now, it is true that if you if you go through the material published in 1789, and someone has done this in France, 10% of the literature is by people who can be identified as Freemasons. That's a high percentage, given that 10% of the male population is not Masonic. But if you then look at what they're writing in every conceivable spectrum of opinion. Royalists, proto-Jacobite, Girondists, avant la lettre, and so forth. So what I think that 10% tells us is that membership in the lodges could act as a form of schooling in government. You voted, you stood up on your feet, you orated, you paid dues, you gave charity, you paid taxes if you were out of line, you were given fines, and these had to be paid if you wanted to remain a member. And I think in many parts of Europe, that kind of experience was unique. And to that extent, one would expect that people who have had that kind of experience would think that they've got something to say about the nature of government, that they've experienced this on an intimate level, and are going to, especially in a revolutionary setting where it's unclear where things are going, they're going to come forward and give their views as to where things should go.
Can I just ask one, drawing on to that point about the lodges as a sort of microcosmos, and whether the older, early modern idea of the microcosmos, say for example the cabinet of rarities, that the lodge in some senses was a microcosmos of a sort of a civil society in the making, that it was an area where they could create a microcosmos. So drawing back into that earlier notion into a modern context.
Yes, I think you can do that, but you have to be careful with it, because if you go into the sociology of these lodges, they also replicate in many, many cases the hierarchical structure in these societies. They are not forward looking in sociological terms in most cases at all. And in fact, one of the hallmarks, particularly of French Freemasonry, and this distinguishes it from Dutch and British Freemasonry, is the amount of infighting that goes on in the 1770s and the 1780s. Go to any lodge and look at the correspondence with the Grand Lodge, and they are fighting about whether the Grand Lodge has insulted them, whether they've admitted people who shouldn't be admitted. There's this social tension. I've always thought that somebody could write a really elegant paper about this material and what it tells you